You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of October 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Ian, when you come, I could sit here and I could say, oh, I'd still vote Remain or oh, I'd vote Leave, just to give you an answer to that question. I'm being open and honest with you. What I did last time round was I looked at everything and came to a judgment, and I'd do exactly the same this time round. But we're not having another referendum, and that's absolutely crucial.
Britain's Prime Minister declines to state that she'd actually vote for her own government's key policy. My guests Carol Walker and Matthew Green will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including, is America's new Afghanistan strategy working any better than any of its predecessors? Have Catalonia and Spain left each other with any constructive options? And is victory in a football match an appropriate cue for a national holiday? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Carol Walker, a political commentator and former BBC political correspondent, and Matthew Green, a journalist and author who has worked in West Africa, Iraq and Afghanistan, among other beats, and whose latest book is Aftershock, The Untold Story of Surviving Peace. Welcome both, and we will start in Afghanistan, Taliban-controlled portions of which are presently on the receiving end of the heaviest American bombing since the much ballyhooed troop surge of 2010. This is the most tangible consequence yet detected of the new Afghanistan strategy announced by President Donald Trump in August, which liberalized rules of engagement for US forces and involved an increased deployment of military advisors. Matthew, as we were just comparing and contrasting before we went to air, you were there most recently of any of us, I think.
About a year ago.
About a year ago. So this is pre-Trump's new strategy. But I guess the question, I'll start with the big question, which is we are now 16 years in to the war in Afghanistan. Does anyone actually know anymore what victory would look like? What the conditions are that enable the forces of the United States and other countries to go, that's it, we've won, well done, we're all going home?
Victory? Andrew, it's a very naive question to be asking at this. The victory? We've been beaten in Afghanistan a number of times over the last 200 years.
And I think that is true. This is round four, is it? Not as far as Britain's concerned.
It's getting there. But it is interesting to see these figures that have just come out showing this big increase in the pace of bombings by the US Air Force in Afghanistan. I think it's the highest level now, isn't it, since 2010?
Since 2010,
which
yes.
is the peak of the troop surge. Obviously, any pretense of counterinsurgency, which was what the troop surge was all about, has now gone. It's just about trying to kill as many Taliban soldiers as possible. But of course, this is an insurgency, and the more liberal you are with airstrikes, the more civilian casualties you cause. That's a bad thing. But it's also a bad thing for the strategy, because it means that more and more people are likely to be driven into the arms of the Taliban. So I don't see that this is going to be breaking that stalemate.
Carol, in fairness, President Ashraf Ghani of Afghanistan has called the new strategy a pathway to certainty, which was an interesting choice of phrase. But does his view, assuming that that accurately reflects it, count for something?
Well, I think it is obviously significant that the president of the country is welcoming it. He thinks that it's going to bolster his forces that have so far proved pretty inadequate in standing up to the Taliban and have been taking some really terrible, heavy casualties in recent months. And it is interesting that Britain, for example, has given its support to what is, after all, a change of strategy by President Trump. It is worth remembering that before he was elected, he was saying that it was time to get out of Afghanistan. He tweeted, US has wasted an enormous amount of blood and treasure in Afghanistan. Let's get out. But once again, the Trump rhetoric has come up hard against the reality on the ground, and he has had to face up to the fact that he simply cannot allow the Taliban to continue to increase its grip on the country. I think the big question is still whether this renewed and stepped up bombing is going to make any more difference than any of the previous surges. If you think back to that high point that you were talking about in terms of the US deployment, the maximum numbers when they had about 100,000 troops there, they didn't reach the point then when they could claim victory. So it's very, very difficult to see whether this is going to have any more of an effective result than those many other previous attempts to try to hold back the Taliban's advance.
It is indeed sometimes as if Donald Trump just says things that pop into his head without having the least idea what he's talking about. Matthew, that aside, is there, do you detect that there's still quite a lot of wishful thinking underpinning the Western strategy in Afghanistan,
yes,
especially in terms of building the Afghanistan, the capacity building, as they call it, the Afghan military? Because about a year ago, I was in Ukraine doing a story for Monocle, which involved spending quite a lot of time with Canadian soldiers who were there training Ukrainian soldiers. But a lot of those Canadian soldiers had previously been training, or as they put it themselves, more attempting to train with exceedingly limited success, Afghan soldiers. There was, I think it's fair to say that among the Canadian soldiers I spoke to, there was a lack of conviction about how enthusiastic the Afghans actually were.
Yeah, and in a way, you can't really blame them. I went back to Kabul about a year ago and spent time interviewing wounded soldiers from the Afghan security forces. And the sorts of predicaments they described on the front line in terms of being just overrun, outnumbered, night after night by Taliban fighters were absolutely terrifying. And of course, you can imagine there's very little in the way of logistical support and certainly medical support. And the casualty rates, I'm glad Carol mentioned that, are absolutely astronomical. The Afghan Ministry of Defense is very cagey about numbers, but we're talking about 5,000 killed in action, probably in a year, 10,000 or tens of thousands of wounded, if you're counting the Afghan army and police. I mean, these are absolutely horrific numbers when you think that the British military lost round about 450 personnel in Afghanistan. We're talking about 4,000 in a single year among the Afghan security forces. And that's a story that's more or less forgotten in the discussion back home in the West.
But just to follow that up, Matthew, and that being the case, is withdrawal any in the, you know, at some point in our lifetimes a realistic option as far as the West is concerned?
I think we could easily be there in 10, 15, 20 years' time.
Because the assumption is, presumably, as soon as the West withdraws, the Taliban take it back again, and then we're back to where we were in the late 90s.
They're already in
which
control.
Went badly.
Approximately 60% or more of the country. They've shown an ability in recent years to be able to overrun provincial capitals and hold them for a few days. The military situation is deteriorating, and that's why Trump has had to step up this air campaign. But it's not going to work. It's just going to, going to make things worse. And that's why in 2010, Stanley McChrystal, who was then in charge of NATO forces, explicitly tighten the rules on airstrikes because he could see how counterproductive they were in terms of causing civilian casualties, killing men, women and children, in other words, and therefore increasing support for the Taliban.
And it is interesting just to note that David Cameron and I went a couple of times to Afghanistan with the British Prime Minister. The whole British strategy was built, as the American was, on training up the Afghan forces. And we were shown wonderful examples of some of the new tricks that they were being taught, some of the new kit that they were being given. But of course, David Cameron then set that deadline to get the British troops out. He did so. There are now a few hundred British troops there. But I think it would be a very brave British Prime Minister that would perform the sort of about face which Donald Trump has done to start sending troops back in any numbers. Because I think that the British public really became very aware of the situation that you've talked about, where there is simply no end in sight against such a determined enemy that is prepared to put its own lives on the line and to kill so many of the local troops who, however much you help them in terms of training and kit, are simply inadequate to face up to that sort of sustained assault.
Well, let's take a look now at the United Kingdom, the Prime Minister of which was yesterday asked by LBC's Ian Dale a question she should probably have seen coming, i.e. the one about which way she would vote in the event of a rerun referendum on EU membership. Theresa May, who campaigned, if rather quietly, for Remain the first time around, noticeably declined to issue a thumping endorsement of the course on which her government claims to be set, merely suggesting that she would come to a judgment. Carol, this is the answer of a sensible woman who knows this whole thing is insane, but can't actually say so, isn't it?
Absolutely. And just about any answer would have been better than the one that she actually gave. I mean, we heard a little clip of it at the beginning of the programme. She was asked, well, if there was a Brexit referendum now, which way would you go? And she said, well, I'd do what I did last time, which was, I'd look at it and, I'd form a judgment. And it just reinforced what everyone can see, which is that she is trapped by the opposing forces within her own party. If she had any strength, any authority in her, strategically, the answer to give would have been the answer that other senior members of her cabinet have given, which is to say, well, look, I campaigned against leaving the European Union because I was a bit concerned about the economic damage it would cause. But now we're set on that course. I can see the fantastic opportunities outside it. I can see the intransigence of the European Union, which is set on much closer integration than we in the UK are prepared to do. And that is why that is my policy. By the answer that she gave, she was effectively giving a vote of no confidence in the policy that she is pursuing. And I think that it will reinforce the doubts of many people in her own party that she simply is not the person to take the party and the country through this process, because sooner or later she is going to have to face up to one side or another within her party.
It is weird, isn't it, Matthew, that if you look at the occupants of the four great offices of state, as they're known here, the Prime Minister, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the Foreign Secretary and the Home Secretary, three are occupied by out-and-out declared Remainers, as they were the first time, and the other one by an opportunist who campaigned for Leave. This is Boris Johnson, of course, but whom I would still bet money voted Remain.
This is the great spectacle that we're watching, you know, unfolding before our eyes, why it's destined to go wrong, because these people are standing up and pursuing a policy that they don't believe in. And there's something that there's so much going on with Theresa May at the moment. It's almost Shakespearean, isn't it? There's something, I think, very poignant at some level about watching her struggle so badly to muster any kind of authority. And I don't just mean authority in terms of her party, but personal authority. She just looks so weak and frail and conflicted. And I would feel sorry for her had she not taken the job to pursue a policy that she didn't believe in. And we're at a time
the argument that she took the job because if she didn't, then somebody completely insane would have.
Yeah, but then the whole thing would have collapsed much quicker, perhaps, if we'd had Andrea Leedsman. Can you imagine?
The thing is, like, we shouldn't joke. It may still come to that.
It might, but I think, aren't we now in a time where all over the world we're seeing a lot of... It's very difficult now to maintain a public persona and conceal what you really think and what you really do. All of these things are coming out of the woodwork all around the world in all different spheres. And I think Theresa May has made a big mistake by essentially following a policy that she just doesn't believe in. Wouldn't it be so much simpler if our leaders just went with their integrity rather than their ambition?
And that, of course, is why the opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn, is doing so well in the polls,
yes,
because people think that whatever they think of his politics, they see him as an authentic politician.
Except the thing is, when you consider how completely disorganised the government is, he's not doing that well in the polls. You would expect any opposition, really, to be a mile in front at this
Indeed.
Point. Carol, is it possibly crediting this government with far too much strategic cunning to suggest that what they are actually trying to do, because, you know, they have all the information that we do and more besides. So if with the information that we have, which I think would convince any rational person that this is going to be an unmitigated catastrophe, they probably know it's going to be even worse. Is it possible that they are just trying to delay this for as long as they possibly can and hoping something changes so no one actually has to go through with this?
No, I think the government is reconciled to the fact that at the end of March, Britain will leave the European Union because that Article 50 has been triggered. We are set on that course. And I think it is very, very difficult to see a set of circumstances that would stop that happening. I think what you are seeing is this battle going on between one half of the cabinet led by the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, who want to stay as close as possible afterwards to the European Union and are saying, look, we've got a huge amount of trade with them. We've got all the common standards. Let's just stay close. And then the three Brexiteers, who is Boris Johnson, the Foreign Secretary, David Davis, who's the man that's doing the negotiations, and Liam Fox, who's the man who's trying to forge some international deals, who are saying, look, let's just give up on the European Union. They're never going to give us what we want. Let us make a point of making a clean break, and then we can forge at least some international trade deals and make a positive result out of that. I think the difficulty for the government at the moment is that they are led by Theresa May, a prime minister who is trying to saddle both horses. Sooner or later, she is going to have to face down one side within her cabinet because they simply cannot continue. I think what is interesting is that the rhetoric preparing us all for leaving the European Union without a deal has now been ratcheted up. I think that that makes sense because it's very likely to happen. And because it's the only thing that is likely to force a bit of compromise from the EU side.
My question being, and just a final thought on this from you, if we are, or if they are preparing for the no deal or hard Brexit, why are they not preparing for it? Why are we not seeing massive infrastructure being built at Dover? Why are we not seeing new customs ports at Hull? Why are they not establishing the new agencies we're going to need? Why are they not hiring and training the hundreds, thousands of extra customs officials that will be necessary? They're not doing anything.
Because Philip Hammond has got, who is the Chancellor, has got to deliver a budget in a few weeks' time. He's already got a great big hole in his budget that he doesn't know how to fill because the government's had to back down on so many of the other ways it was going to try and fill it. And he doesn't want to commit money to that no-deal scenario yet. He said that he will do if it becomes necessary. I think that's looking increasingly likely.
OK, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Carol Walker and Matthew Green. Coming up next, is Catalonia or isn't it? And will Spain or won't it?
Weighing in at almost 400 pages, the Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The book is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. And it's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks too. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in, and it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cosy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Carol Walker and Matthew Green. Now, yesterday's semi-declaration of sort of independence by Catalonia's president, Charles Puigdemont, may have wrong-footed his more ardently nationalist supporters, but it has also discombobulated the government of Spain, which finds itself presented with a bunch of options which all look like either capitulation or overreaction. Spain's Prime Minister, Mariano Rajoy, has therefore followed Puigdemont in suggesting that he might do something drastic at some future juncture, specifically in his instance, imposing direct rule on Catalonia. Matthew, first of all, Puigdemont did his big speech yesterday. A lot of people thought he was going to get up and declare independence at 5 o'clock. At shortly after 6 o'clock, after doubtless an awful lot of frenetic conversations and rewriting, he kind of didn't. He didn't.
He pulled back, didn't he?
I don't want to say bottled it, but he kind of, it was odd.
Well,
strange thing to do.
And probably a sensible thing to do, given the situation. I mean, I'm guessing. We were just talking a moment ago about this whole scenario, but is this part of the outbreak of kind of global irrationality and madness that we've seen with Brexit, with Trump and everything else that's going on at the moment? Because I can't see a reason why you'd want to suddenly break Spain into two separate countries any more than Scotland should leave the UK leave Canada.
It does seem like a sort of massive hassle for very little imaginable upside. I mean, is it that same dynamic in that you first of all, as Matthew said, we've seen with Brexit, with Trump, with various other populist tantrums, you have the kind of atavistic, sentimental outburst, and then reality sets in quite quickly. And it set in very fast in Catalonia's case, because France made it clear that nobody would recognise Catalonia. It would be slung out of the EU. And I suspect more to the point, as far as Puigdemont was concerned, because Catalonia's big thing is that it makes loads of money and pays too much tax. But it was made very clear to him that several large employers would up stakes and go elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, clearly there was some momentum behind that independence movement. Puigdemont seemed to decide to seize his moment to try to push that to the vote. It's interesting, my daughter is living and working out there and was very much pointing out the fact that that very heavy-handed response from the Spanish authorities when on polling day...
That was an absolute present to the Catalonian government, wasn't it?
It absolutely was. And many, many people who beforehand were ambivalent or even opposed to independence felt that those heavy-handed tactics by the Spanish government, where we saw the police rushing in and beating up old ladies, made them convinced that independence was now a cause worth supporting. Of course, although a majority in that referendum did vote for independence, less than half of the population in Catalonia actually voted for it. So Spain does have a point when it says, look, this is not a legitimate vote. The other thing, of course, that Rajoy has got on his side is that the rest of the European Union has been very reluctant to criticise his heavy-handed tactics, because so many other European nations have breakaway provinces, regions in their own countries, and the last thing they want to do is to encourage the sort of sentiments that have led to this Catalonian movement. The last thing they want to see is the breakup of their own countries. And it was fascinating to hear Nicola Sturgeon, who is Scotland's first minister, who was in an absolute dilemma at the weekend when she was asked which side she would support. And she said that whilst she thought it was very important for people to have self-determination, she wasn't going to criticise the Spanish because she might need their help when it comes to Scotland's future.
Looking at Spain's response, Matthew, is there a certain amount of cold reality dawning on them as well? I mean, they did learn, well, hopefully they learned something from their bizarre response to the actual vote, that the more you kind of clamp down, the more you inflame your opposition. Is that why Rajoy is being a bit cagey about the imposition of direct rule? Because, again, it must... I mean, if this has occurred to me, I hope it's occurred to Rajoy that if he announces that, then that completely seals the deal as far as independence goes.
Yeah, exactly.
It?
I mean, presumably his best bet is to play for time, isn't it, at this stage, and let this kind of anxiety, this crest of anger...
He's recently, in the last few minutes, said he wants some sort of response from Catalonia within 5 days. So I think...
Yeah.
Which is a confident thing to say. I think this is Spain suggesting, you know, come and have a go if you think you're hard enough.
And isn't there some debate over whether that 5 days includes the weekend and the bank holiday?
Exactly.
It could be a little bit of wiggle room. Maybe it goes into next week. Yeah. His best bet, isn't it, is to play it slow. Because, like you say, there's been this great wave of anger. That will abate and the anxiety will start to kick in. Because there's no way this... Everyone knows. It's delusional that this can be somehow be, suddenly emerge as an independent country. It's not going to happen. And people must understand that at some deep level.
What is the likeliest imaginable resolution to this, though? I mean, because I think, as Matthew suggests, I think it seems unlikely that Catalonia really would leave Spain, especially in light of all the consequences it has, I think, begun to absorb in the last week or so. But Puigdemont, having taken his people so far out on this, he's going to want something. He needs to be able to claim a victory of some sort.
There is this let's talk movement, isn't there, which is trying to put pressure on both sides to back down and to negotiate. And ultimately, these sorts of matters can only be settled by negotiation. One would hope that the two sides could find some sort of accommodation, which could perhaps lead to Catalonia having a bit more autonomy without breaking away altogether. But the difficulty is that both sides are talking hardball at the moment. As you say, Mariano Rajoy is trying to put the Catalans in the situation where they make the next move so that he can then accuse them of trying to provoke a fight. I think what is needed now is the maximum amount of international pressure, in particular pressure from the rest of the European Union, to try to get both sides to back down, back away from the threats and the counter threats and the heavy-handed tactics of the police and the demonstrations out on the streets, and get round to try to discuss some way in which Catalonia could be given a bit more autonomy without going for the full independence.
Well, finally tonight, our congratulations to Panama, which in addition to a canal and a Van Halen song can add to its list of achievements, the hats actually originated in Ecuador before anyone writes in, reaching the World Cup finals for the first time. Panama beat Costa Rica 2-1 to secure passage to Russia next summer, although not without controversy. Gabriel Torres' opening goal for Panama did not appear to cross the line, and the result also meant that the United States have not qualified, none of which was of concern to Panama's president, Juan Carlos Varela, who spontaneously gave the country a day off. Matthew, this was basically the president resigning himself to inevitability. I mean, no one. I was reminded, in fact, of 1983 in Australia, when Australia won the America's Cup, the sailing competition. The prime minister at the time, Bob Hawke, was asked if there would be a holiday, and he replied, I think to the effect that such a thing was not in his power to decree, but he did add that any anybody who sacks someone for not turning up to work today is a bum.
But is this, I'm not clear, is this a one-off or is this now an annual event?
It would be brilliant if it was. I think it's just a one-off spontaneous national holiday.
Don't we get them sometimes when the royal family does something, or is that my imagination? When babies are born, weddings happen?
We didn't get a day off for Prince George,
get a day off for Prince George. But there was a Conservative MP who actually took a bill into the House saying that we should have had a day off for the Queen's, this was the Queen's Sapphire Jubilee, 65 years on the throne this summer. And Andrew Rossendale actually tried to get a bill through Parliament to say that that should be a national holiday.
Do we like the idea of spontaneous national holidays? Just like the government just making a gesture just saying, you know what, sod it. Everyone, take a day off.
Well, politicians know, you know, giving you an extra day off is always going to be popular. It is worth remembering that at the last general election, Jeremy Corbyn, who is the leader of the main opposition Labour Party, actually had a policy of an extra 4 public holidays in the UK, one on each of the saints' days of the patron saints of England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. And of course, the government's response was to say, well, you know, the entire economy would be on holiday permanently if Jeremy Corbyn was to be in power.
I mean, Matthew, what about the idea of holidays commemorating sporting events? Because, and again, I insert an example from my own homeland here. The state of Victoria has long had one for Melbourne Cup Day. It's a horse race, and the rest of the country pretty much takes that day off anyway. If you ever want to invade Australia, our foreign enemies, first Tuesday in November, you'd get a bit of a head start. But Victoria also added another one just this year, Grand Final Eve, the day before the Australian Rules Grand Final, is now a holiday in the state.
I'm all for more public holidays, Andrew. You're never going to get me on this programme and arguing against public holidays.
But the thing is, like, you're freelance, well, Matthew, as am I. We know that they mean nothing to us.
I was going to say
I didn't notice Easter this year.
In the gig economy, there needs to be, someone needs to design some sort of app or something that will allow those of us who work on an occasional basis to be somehow rewarded. Maybe just some money could be sent to us. I think that would be a much better policy.
I would vote for that all day.
just like
freelancers just being given money.
I'll just take my day rate for that day, and then
that'll
get my vote.
Idea.
I did note that there was actually a petition got up to say that should be a national holiday in the UK on the day after the release of the new edition of Call of Duty, this online game that a lot of people play.
Because, that's like
because
sports,
they
almost
release it at midnight, and so, of course, and apparently, on the day after the last edition was released, according to the petition, and I haven't checked these figures, about 8 million people called in sick because they'd all been up all night playing the new edition. But I have to say, the petition didn't get very far.
Not many signatures?
75 when I last checked.
75. Yeah, that's going to need work. I think we need to congratulate Panama. I hope they are enjoying their day off. It's about lunchtime in Panama City. Panama, if you're listening, well done and enjoy Russia. That does bring us to the end of today's show. Carol and Matthew, thank you both very much for joining us. The show was produced by Henry Rees Sheridan, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alessio Dallana. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next at 1900, Daniel Giacopelli with The Entrepreneurs. There's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns tomorrow at 1800. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.